You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, August 30th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
And we're back. Just like five musketeers.
It's always fun to be at Dragon Con. This is always a unique show for us every year. Very unique, in fact, I would say.
I love when we say that.
At Dragon Con, I could say, you, Steve.
No, you shouldn't, though, because I said that word in front of some Boy Scouts earlier this morning. I got yelled at.
You got hollered at?
Yeah. Hey! That's what the Boy Scout leader said.
So, Bob and Rebecca, I understand you had a classic Dragon Con moment earlier this morning.
Yes. All right. We're both in the parade as in the Bruce group. Lots of different Bruces. So I was Bruce Lee, of course, and Rebecca was Bruce Campbell, Ash, played by Bruce Campbell. And so I go into the Hilton, and I'm looking for everybody, and I don't see anybody. So I sit down. And there's some girl sitting over there with short, dark hair. I'm like, well, okay. I sit down. 10 minutes. I'm sitting next to Rebecca.
At the same table.
Then she shouted something, and that voice sounded familiar. I looked, and it was Rebecca sitting right next to me.
Is he behind me, Rebecca? I'm like, Rebecca? Bob?
We both start laughing as we look at each other's black wigs and blood and whatever. We just start laughing, and it was an awesome moment.
I like the part of the story where Rebecca just for no reason yells, like just shouts out.
That's how I roll. Sometimes I yell.
And Evan, you've walked past people without being noticed.
Oh, it was great. Yeah, I don't know. Is Pamela Gay here? I don't know. Saw her coming. I just stood right there. I wanted to see what would happen. She came towards me. That was it. Walked right by me. And then I said, Pamela Gay. She turned around. No idea. She's like squinting at me. She's like, who the heck is that? I take off the glasses. And I say, it's me. And she's like, oh, I only ever see you in a shirt with no beard and red hair. And what's going on? It was awesome.
I only see you with dead hookers lying around you. What's going on?
No, that would have been somebody else.
I want to take a quick vote here. Who thinks Evan should keep the beard?
Oh.
Totally.
Yeah, it suits you.
It's awesome.
All right.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you. Appreciate that. I will strongly consider it.
I will consider it.
Yeah, I like the jacket. I like the coat, too.
The whole look.
Thank you. Yeah, stay with this. You like the black hair?
Yeah, the Simon Pegg look. Yeah, it works.
And now you're the only redhead on the panel. What's with that?
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, but that's a wig.
It's
I couldn't tell.
Did you get that a lot?
It's not a wig.
I did my same costume again this year. I went as a science podcaster again. But some people don't recognize me in costumes. All right, Rebecca, this day in skepticism.
Yeah, 1891, it was the first operation to suture the pericardium. What's that, Steve?
Peri means around, and cardium means the heart.
Okay, so it's the first operation to suture something around the heart. So 1891, which was a lot earlier than I thought it would be, it happened in St. Louis, and the patient was a 22-year-old black man who had been stabbed. His name is James Cornish, and it was successful.
Mm-hmm. Did he survive?
He did, apparently.
That's like the running joke. The operation was successful, but the patient died.
Right.
Steve, is the pericardium, like how thick is it? Have you seen it, right?
Yeah, it's like a thick fibrous lining around the heart.
Like
how
thick would you describe it?
I don't know.
Is it like a condom? Like I'm not
No,
joking.
Thicker. I mean, it's... Several millimeters.
Is it clear?
No. It's fibrousy and opaque.
Okay. I've never seen one. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, let's hope you never will.
Jay, we've watched enough horror movies together to know what a heart looks like pulled out of someone's chest, right? How many times have we seen that?
Yeah, but I don't know what I'm looking at. I don't know if it's that. We'll move on.
But yeah, it was at a time period where they did generally... the medical establishment frowned upon surgical interventions when it came to the heart. And so it was a quite bold experiment. So, yeah.
But it opened up an era of heart surgery, which now is routine. I mean, now we could do it through the blood vessels. Just snake a little wire in there. They're doing trans arterial valve replacements now. They can replace valves in your heart without ever having to open your chest. Still, you know, experimental and only for high-risk patients who for the surgery. But still, I mean, in 10, 20 years, I mean, that's probably going to be totally standard. Yeah. You know, don't even have to open the chest anymore.
Still waiting for my robot heart.
Yep. All right, so did you guys know that archaeologists found hard proof that a time traveler
yep.
went back in time and shot and killed a Neanderthal?
Steve, I have a question.
Yeah.
Was that Neanderthal Hitler?
No, it was not. It was not the Hitler Neanderthal.
No, but we don't know, do we?
Well,
because he was shot.
That's true. This is true.
Had he not been shot, he would have been Neanderthal Hitler.
So, actually, I think it
in this other timeline, everybody's like, as soon as they invent time travel, somebody's got to go back and kill Neanderthal Hitler.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think it actually was Ramtha.
The...
Wait, Ramtha killed Hitler?
So no, the Neanderthal that was killed was Ramtha, which is the Neanderthal that Jay-Z Knight channels.
Right, with like a weird accent.
Yeah,
right?
That.
So yeah, you'll hear, you know, recounting the story of getting shot.
Namaste.
A joke was too subtle, Steve.
I got it. I liked it.
You got it? All right.
Yeah.
So
skeptic joke.
Okay, this is a story. It revolves around a skull, a Neanderthal skull with apparently a perfect hole in it that doesn't show the signs of like a low velocity impact. Like if a spear or a rock or something or a club hit it, there would be a certain pattern of fracture lines, and those were missing. So therefore, it must have been a high velocity round object. And they even said that there were fractures on the opposite side of the skull, as if the bullet had gone all the way through the skull and then fractured the other side. Clearly, that would have been a lethal shot. The problem is that every single fact in the story is wrong.
What about the time-traveling part?
Except perhaps the time-traveling part.
So the hole is fake? Like somebody faked the hole to, you know, hit it with a hammer or something?
It's not that the hole is fake.
Did a raptor do it? Whoa, you're laughing? Because I have you never do. Oh, okay.
Raptors make
be quiet
holes.
Because I'll tell you, not to go off into another tangent here, but yeah, like they did a study on monkey skulls, and there's a lot of them that have holes in them, and raptors do it. They literally get killed by birds.
You're talking about birds, okay?
That's all right. I got it. Thank you. I'm an idiot.
Much less entertaining.
Never mind.
Yes.
Yeah, raptor the bird, not raptor right. the fucker that eats you.
Yeah,
not the dinosaur, not the non-avian dinosaur.
Yeah.
Right, so anyway, I also noticed looking at this story that if this story revolves around a skull and there's no picture of the skull in the story. It's like, wouldn't you show the key piece of evidence in the story? So the story, Neanderthal, 35,000 years old, perfect hole, no fracture lines, clearly a fatal shot.
I'm sorry, where's the perfect hole?
Yeah, so it's the little thing right there. Is that
over
showing
the ear,
up?
Where the ear should be.
On
the
it's not showing up.
No, but where's the
eye?
Perfect hole?
Yeah, yeah, so.
Now.
It's relatively perfect.
If there are any archaeologists or paleoanthropologists in the audience, you may notice that this is not a Neanderthal skull.
And with our audience, it's very likely that
It's likely because we always have experts in the audience that know more than we do about the items that we're talking about. So,
Steve, where'd you get this picture?
This is the picture. That's the skull. But it's just not a Neanderthal skull. That is an early human, probably Homo rhodesiensis or some related species, but not Neanderthal. Also, the skull was found in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. Neanderthal man never existed in Africa. They were a European species. So saying that there was a Neanderthal skull from Africa right there, that's wrong.
Where'd the hole come from?
So that's a good question. So the hole is partially healed. And that you can see. If somebody died from a fracture that happened in a piece of bone, if it happened after death, or if they survived it and it healed before they died. So there's healing fibrous tissue around the inside of that hole. So this guy survived whatever made that hole in his skull. So clearly it wasn't a gunshot wound. Also, there are no fractures on the other side of the skull. That's just made up. So what this probably was a bone abscess. This was probably not even traumatic. It was probably pathological. Bone abscess, which is an infection in the skull. He survived it long enough for it to partially heal. That was probably what eventually killed
him.
Your
skull can get infected?
Oh, yeah. Bones can get infected. It's really bad.
It's living tissue, Jay.
I've never heard of that.
Pre-antibiotics, that's a death sentence, pretty much.
So did it kill him, though? What do you think?
Well, yeah, as I said, that, I mean, he survived long enough for the bone to partially heal, but it's possible that that infection that caused that hole also eventually killed him.
And he clearly didn't floss.
Clearly.
That would have helped, right?
That could have killed him. The bacteria from there could have went up to his heart.
That's true.
His brain.
This is true. So 128,000 to 300,000 years old. So they got the date wrong, the species wrong, the type of hole wrong.
Oh, so he probably died of old age then.
Yeah. Ba-dum-bum.
It's okay. Yeah.
Nothing.
Nope. Okay.
Nope. Okay. Nope. Nah.
So,
this is not right.
We have been placing science news stories on the SGU site, the science news section. If you haven't checked it out, check it out. We're trying to put at least three items there a day, and we're building our repertoire of writers so that there'll be more and more. We have a weekly installment, Weird Wildlife Wednesday, which goes up, strangely enough, on Wednesday. And that's Kate Christian is writing that for us. This is the most recent one, and this is just this. You have to love this picture. What's fascinating about this picture is that the eyes in the front of the head are not its eyes.
Yeah.
Those are not eyes. That's his nose. Those are like sensory sensing nares type nasal organ.
Yeah, because it looks like his eyes, and he looks like super sad.
Yeah.
So does he have eyes?
He has eyes.
Take a close look.
The eyes are the green orbs in the middle of its head, and the top of its head is see-through so that it can see.
So now it's just a free
straight up. So this is the Macropinna microstoma, or the barrel eye fish, and it lives at the border zone between the part of the ocean that light penetrates and then the part of the ocean that is where that light doesn't penetrate, that's completely dark. So he's really just survives on that border zone looking up, and they believe that the looking up eyes are adapted for looking for bioluminescent glow of siphonophores. Mm. Siphonophores.
So at the top of his head is pretty much one giant eye.
It's two eyes.
Yeah.
No. But you know what I mean.
Eyes, you know what I mean. It's like one giant
like we
cornea.
We have clear tissue in front of our, you know what I mean? Like. Yeah.
Also, those eyes can shift forward. That's one thing they never realize. As when it goes to get its prey and it heads up, those green globs can actually like move forward, which wasn't verified until recently. But that, how do I go so long in my life and not see a picture of this guy? He's incredible.
What's it called?
Wow.
The barrel eye fish. Pretty darn cool. This is a delectable dish of insects and other arthropods. And, Jay, this is what we're going to be living off of in the future, I understand.
Yeah. Well, first, I'd like to say I found this item off of I Fucking Love Science, and I just love the work that she's doing there. So check this out. So I'm just going to hit you with some facts. There's 70 million people each year. The population grows by 70 million people each year. That's a lot of people. By 2050, we're going to be up to 9 billion people. And they're saying, and I don't understand the math here, but they're saying, but when we hit 9 billion, we have to double our food production.
Yeah, I didn't get that either.
Yeah, but that's what it said. So I'm just letting you know that might
be wrong.
Is that
because there's going to be increased waste in the system? I mean, there's got to be something else in there.
But yeah, there's information we don't have.
But it's going to be more.
But even still, you know, yeah.
9 billion
there's
versus
be
7 billion, yeah.
Significant increase in the amount of food we have to produce. So that being said, food's going to be a huge problem, and GMO, who knows if the GMO industry is going to be able to help us that much. You know, it's still pretty, you know, it's so early in the GMO history that we don't know how effective it's going to be. It seems like it's going to be.
The best stuff is still experimental.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, other things to keep in mind, we're using 70% of the available agricultural land that's on the planet. So we might be able to solve some of these problems with, you know, increasing places that we can grow food, maybe, you know, on top of the ocean somehow, or even in the ocean. There could be a lot of food that we can pull out of the water. Fish populations are dwindling. Guys, it looks like we're going to be eating bugs. It's really hard culturally in the United States. We don't like it, right? I don't know. Anybody here eat bugs and like them? And like them. All right.
Two or three people
out of about what? How many people are in
10,
this room?
10, at least.
Yeah.
Well, they're ahead of the curve, apparently.
So there are 2 billion people alive today that have bugs be a major part of their diet. That's a lot of people. So there's a lot of reasons why we would want to eat bugs or want to use them for farming. The list is so huge, I can't even go into it. But, you know, a couple of things to keep in mind are that bugs are easy to grow. They don't take up as much food to grow them. Like, you know, pound for pound, they're a lot more efficient than growing red meat, as an example. And plus, you could eat the whole frickin' thing. they consider bug growth or growing bugs commercially to be a green effort because the amount of gas that's produced and the amount of energy that goes into it is significantly less than most other farming.
What about zombies?
For food? You want to use them for food?
Well, we could use people if we can resort to cannibalism. I mean, think about...
Is it cannibalism if you eat a zombie?
I don't know. That's a good question. You have to become a zombie first. Think about it. They're with all these people, whenever they die, we either cremate them or we put them in the ground and they get eaten by worms and stuff. But
so you're saying that we should eat people?
Well, that's a waste of calories. But, I mean, you can't... People aren't going to eat them directly.
Steve, I really want you to deliver the eulogy at my funeral.
So you have to... I know. there's no way to brand that to make it work. You've got to process them in such a way that people won't recognize that it's people.
Maybe a green color.
Yeah.
It should be green.
Yeah.
Call it something that sounds like food, like soy-ish. Soy-ish green.
Yeah, soy-like something.
It'll work.
But I want to skip down to the section that talks about how do bugs taste very, very quickly. So there's all these different bugs. There's 1,900 or 2,000 different kinds of bugs that we could eat. And they're describing all these different kinds of bugs in here and how they taste. And some taste minty and some taste like watermelon and some taste like this and all that.
Earthy? Taste earthy? Much. Nutty? I heard nutty a lot.
Yeah, nutty.
Nutty
does
I can
up.
See. Watermelon I find quite surprising.
Like they're saying that like you could eat a scorpion. And you're cooking it. Don't worry. Cooking it gets rid of the venom. Wow. But they have a slightly fishy taste, so stay away from them.
Really?
Yeah. But tarantulas, like on the other hand, they could taste like shrimp and crab.
Oh, tarantulas are sweet, though.
Come on, shrimps, crabs, lobsters, those are bugs. They're arthropods. They are basically
the
insects of the sea.
No. Wait, hold on.
So if you eat lobsters and shrimp, and look at a shrimp, that's a bug.
Yeah, but wait, I have a good point here. Now, when you eat a lobster, you eat the lobster tail, or you could eat the claws, or you're eating, you know, crabs, or you're taking the meat out of the claws and everything. When you eat cockroaches, you eat the whole thing.
Yeah.
You're eating its brain. I'm swearing a lot tonight, aren't
you
I?
You are.
I'm sorry.
Yes, you are.
I'm very angry. So anyway, so you're taking like a big chunk of meat out of it, but with bugs, like you eat the whole thing. They'll just grind them up and you're eating their brains and their internal organs and
sure.
their juices.
They don't have brains though, Jay.
Whatever they have.
They have goo. Ganglia. There's goo. There's goo in there.
So I'm not. I'm
and
not
you're already eating them anyway.
That's true. That was the other thing. Yeah, so if you eat ketchup, you're eating a certain amount of bugs that they allow. So pretty much everything that we eat that's massively produced has insects in it already. So there's an acceptable amount of insects that we're already eating.
How's that lab?
Lab-grown meat. Yeah. It's not going to feed the world.
No? Why not?
No. Not by 2050. No way. So, yeah, we're going to be eating bugs. I mean, that's the bottom line.
I'm not.
Why not, Bob? Look how delectable they are.
I would rather starve. I'm not going to eat bugs.
So, look, I found a recipe.
Lab-grown meat.
Poppin' good cricket
Poppin' good cricket fried rice. We're going to make this and eat it. We're going to eat this. I wanted to
eat... Wait. You say we?
Yes.
We?
Yes. I wanted to eat a cicada, you know, during, if you recall.
Yeah.
But the whole cicada thing cycle was a bust. I didn't see one cicada.
I saw one.
But anyway, you'll notice that comes from this site, insectsarefood.com. Yeah. Which proves...
Does what it says on the tin.
It does. It proves there is a website for everything.
Right. There's also a pornographic version of this.
Yeah. Well, that goes without saying.
How many hopping good crickets do you put in this recipe?
So, yeah, how many do you want to serve?
So you don't chop them up, you serve them whole?
Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to make the recipe and find out.
And they make flour out of bugs that is gaining popularity. And it's a really easy way to work bugs into your diet without the legs sticking in your teeth.
I'm so not...
It's like a bush and toothpick, though. I find it convenient.
Rebecca, maggots don't have feet, don't have legs. And all you got to do is leave your food out, and then you get the maggots.
I am not eating at your house.
Like cheese. Remember the maggot cheese? They deliberately let maggots crawl through the cheese.
Oh, yeah.
It's real to delicacy. So,
Steve, I love how it says garlic powder to taste. I would have like a bucket of garlic powder.
Yeah, and also at that point, why are all these powdered spices? Like, you're already going to the trouble to get crickets and cook them up. Like, do it right. Like, you know,
Rebecca, curry has a ton of bugs in it.
Curry does?
Powder, all curry powder has a lot of insect parts in it.
Wow.
So it makes it so delicious.
So for some reason, this news item prompted the question among the five of us, what word would you least want to be associated with something that you eat? I'll give you some ideas. So here are some. So mine was squirming. That was at the top of my list.
Yeah.
Wouldn't want my food to ever be described as squirming.
Which it will.
Which it may, yeah. Not, at least not while I'm eating it. If it had squirmed, that's still not good.
Yeah, you're saying you'll eat it post-squirm.
Post-squirm, yeah. But while, I don't want squirming in my mouth, like, no.
Is that Klingon dish? Gok.
Yeah, the Klingon dish. Rebecca's was sentient because she's a liberal. but was that you, Evan, or Bob?
That was me.
Evan was bloody.
No blood.
Bloody.
No, what's wrong with bloody?
No bloody.
Wasn't on my short list. I don't like decomposers. It's just. I'm a super taster, so fungus tastes like toe cheese to me. Not that I've ever tasted toe cheese, but I'm sure that I'm just no. I just know that's what it tastes like. So yeah, no decomposers.
Challenge accepted. Blind experiment time.
Bob first
close
said,
your eyes and open your mouth.
Bob said fatty. I'm like, Bob, dude, fatty? You're not getting the spirit of this.
They didn't explain it well initially, but so I got the point.
What did you come up with next? Salty.
We went to slimy. Yeah, slimy. Necrotic. Mm.
I said that one.
Yeah.
At which point Steve pointed out that you eat meat. It's all, or I think you put it.
I did. Yeah. Yeah. It's dead flesh.
In fact, dead flesh.
We
that's
age
necrotic.
Meat. We age yeah. meat to make it more necrotic. Right.
No, but yeah. isn't necrotic jerky. Mean
dead like, tissue? Jay.
You're
necrotic
picturing something
is dead
festering.
Tissue.
Yeah, like isn't that necrotic?
No, no. That's infected.
Jay, you were looking for putrescent. Which
there
is
you go.
But that was but Rebecca, yeah. festering that goes on the list.
That yeah. would go. Yeah, that's
festering. Add festering to the list, and then oh, maggoty.
That's not a word.
Never good.
And we're getting very specific.
Like maggoty bread
yeah,
from Lord right, of the Rings?
Okay.
Come on. All right, we do have to get serious now, though, because Rebecca's going to tell us about a friend of science and skepticism, Victor Stenger, who unfortunately passed away a few days ago.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry that we have to do such a depressing news item at a live show, but it's true. Vic Stenger was not just a friend of science and skepticism. He was also a friend of mine and just an absolutely amazing man. He was 79 years old. He had an aneurysm and died. Left behind his awesome wife, Phyllis, and two kids. If you don't know, if you're not familiar with Vic Stenger's work, you should check it out. He was a particle physicist, as well as a staunch skeptic and atheist. Maybe his most famous book was God, the Failed Hypothesis, in which he set out to disprove the idea of God using scientific principles, which is something that's not often done by somebody in such a hard field, you know, like particle physics. He worked with Center for Inquiry quite a bit. He wrote articles for them. And I had the great pleasure of being able to hang out with him a number of times at various conferences. And and he was just, I can't even like tell you what an amazing guy he was. When you see Vic, you can look at the picture. He's a bit of an imposing man because he's this esteemed particle physicist who's written, you know, a dozen amazing books. And at first, he comes across as a little grumpy. And I remember one of the first times we hung out, we got in a fight over because I had just gotten married, and he said, "What's your last name now?" And I said, "Watson." And he said, "Oh, you have to take your husband's last name." And I was like, "Oh, it's on." And we sat in this bar for like 2 hours arguing. And from that day forward, every time I saw him, he would greet me with, "Hello, Mrs. Watson." And one time we were at a conference in Copenhagen, and we, as part of the conference, the organizers arranged this very nice tour down a river. We were in like a riverboat, and we got out, and then all of the speakers, there were quite a number of us, were split into groups and taken around by tour guides. So we got out of the boat, and it starts to drizzle. And so it's a really not a very nice day. And our tour guide starts by telling us, things like the number of trees in Copenhagen and just like the most boring facts you would ever not want to know about this amazing city that you happen to be in. She was really, truly horrible.
But Rebecca, how many trees were there?
50,007 at Excellent. The time. And so she's leading us around, and Vic and his wife and I were at the back of the group lagging behind when Vic turns to me and says, should we just sneak away? She probably wouldn't even notice. Like, there was a group of maybe 10 of us, and she was just was droning on and on and on. And so that's what we did. We just got slower and slower and waited for the group to go around a corner, and then we all just ran in the other direction. And we found a bar with, like, an outdoor patio that was covered in, like, overhangs. So it was really starting to rain. So we sit and we get our Carlsberg beers and we just proceed to have the loveliest day. You know, it's pouring down rain, but we're undercover. We have beers. We're eating, like, French fries. Just having a blast. And at some point, I look up and I see one of the other tour groups walking, and James Randi is there wearing a head-to-toe, like, blue condom thing to keep himself dry from the rain. And everybody in the group just looked miserable, absolutely miserable. And as they pass by, we're, like,
toasted them.
We're covering our eyes, and Vic is turning away. And as they get by, I'm like, okay, I think we're in the clear. And I look up, and Randi turned around, made eye contact, and just goes...
Nice.
And just points at
just
you accusingly.
Points at us. Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah.
But he was a good bro and didn't give us up.
Didn't rat you out.
Yeah. And we had a lovely time.
Real quick, I greatly admired Victor. I didn't know him, and I'm kind of really pissed at Rebecca for not ever introducing me to him at this point.
Sorry.
But it's okay. But he was great because when I was first getting into physics and trying to do research on physics to counter pseudoscientific claims, he was the guy to go to because he was one of the first guys that really, really was just so prolific and addressed that so much. So he was fantastic for that. So he was my go-to guy to deal with that kind of stuff.
And he was just so amazing. Great about using complicated, hard science and simplifying it for a lay audience and making it entertaining and easily digestible.
That's such a skill, and you know, not enough people have it. You know, there's so few out there that are really doing it so well. So it's really a big loss.
When I was in London, I was doing the Little Adams podcast with Neil Denny, and Vic was vacationing in London, and so we went to interview him at his hotel room, and Neil was beside himself, just so nervous because this is the great Vic Stenger. Yeah. And I tried to assure him, he's the nicest guy, really. And we ring the doorbell, and the door opens, and Vic is standing there in his bathrobe, wearing like boxers and an undershirt. He's like, yep, come on in. And Neil's like, we just met Dr. Stenger, and he's in his pants. So anyway, he was an amazing guy. He'll be missed.
So Bob, now we're gonna test your skills at explaining difficult science in easy and understandable terminology. You're going to tell us, you're going to explain everything about this picture in 2 minutes.
Thanks for turning up the pressure. That's what I needed.
Do it.
You can do it.
So astronomers...
Victor.
Do it for Ben.
Channel him now.
Astronomers have determined that the X-rays that are diffused throughout our environment are caused by what you're seeing here is a local bubble that surrounds not only our solar system, but 300 light years in every direction. And the story behind it is really interesting. It was very mysterious because when X-ray astronomy was born decades ago, they looked up into the heavens and they saw these soft X-rays everywhere, and they were kind of shocked. They did not expect it. They were trying to figure out, all right, where did these X-rays come from? So it was a real mystery. But one of the things that they learned was that it was very, very low energy. So that means that it has to be very close to us. So that helped because these were just point sources of X-rays. They could be a billion light years away, or they could be, you know, just a few light minutes away. But because of their energy, they knew it was close. So that really narrowed the range. So they said, all right, so this, what could this possibly be? One option was that supernovas millions of years ago exploded And when a supernova goes off, it pretty much pushes everything aside. It just keeps anything that's there, any of the gas, dust, anything, is pretty much pushed aside. So it creates these huge voids. And that's the local bubble. That's what creates this local bubble. It's very, very low density area of space that we're all in, that everything around us is in. We're talking maybe an atom per liter of space, opposed to, say, 10 atoms. So it's like 1/10 the density. So it's very, very low density, even for interstellar space. So that was just one theory, that supernovas created this. But there's other possibilities, and that was causing, you know, deepening the mystery and causing the controversy. Another option is something called solar wind charge exchange. You can have the solar wind from the sun. These are ions coming from the sun. And when they interact with matter, they can produce X-rays that are very similar to what we're seeing here. So they really didn't know. They were going back and forth. So to find out what happened, they got some old X-ray detectors, and they totally modified them and adapted them, made them very modern, and they sent them up in sounding rockets 160 miles in the air. They had 5 minutes of detection time before it came back down. So within that 5 minutes, these detectors did the most sensitive and thorough examination of these X-rays that had ever been done. The end result was basically that 40% of the X-rays, of these soft X-rays that are coming to us, are coming from this solar wind charge exchange. So that means that 60% of the X-rays are coming from deep. They're coming from, you know, within 300 light years, where the other ones are coming from, you know, maybe a few AUs, 93 million miles, so that they're very close. So they basically gave the best evidence that we have yet, that we exist in these huge bubbles of very low density space. And it's interesting, not only will we learn more about the evolution of, say, our galaxy, because we've been traveling through it for 5 to 10 million years, so that could impact us. What's going to happen when we leave this bubble, because we're moving in a different direction than the bubble? So what's going to happen? And the other interesting thing I think of when I see this is, you know, 5 or 10 million years ago, we weren't on the Earth, but these monkey-like apes were on the Earth, and at some point they probably looked up and they saw, you know, multiple supernovas going off, and that must have been an amazing sight. Imagine, you know, 4 or 5 suns worth of light, you know, all of a sudden appearing. That would have been pretty amazing, and yeah. I wonder what, you know, they obviously survived, because we wouldn't have been here. It could have wiped out all the life on the Earth if they were just a little bit closer, but instead we're just in this amazing bubble of low density space.
Yeah, so eventually though, our sun is going to move out of the bubble, or right, the bubble is not traveling exactly along with us. Is that fair?
Right.
So if the interstellar medium outside of the bubble is 10 times as dense, would that affect solar wind or anything conditions on the Earth?
I would think that it would impact the heliosphere, right?
Yeah.
The area of influence that the sun has.
You think we get like some level of protection from that?
Yeah, we certainly do. You know, the medium around our sun, the heliosphere, is different, and that's why when the probes, you know, breached it, it was a great opportunity to learn what was going on. But I remember reading a few years ago about people wondering what's going to happen. I mean, it's going to be so much time; we really don't have to worry about it. But it's interesting to think about what would happen once we leave that area of the bubble and enter true interstellar space.
There's also, you know, plans. One design for a possible interstellar craft is to like have a big scoop in the front, a magnetic scoop that scoops up
busted
the
ramjet, yeah.
Yeah, to the hydrogen, the interstellar hydrogen, and use that as fuel. So, but all the 90% of our fuel is missing for this kind of ship. Right, so that, I wonder if that is going to make it a lot more challenging until the ship gets out of the bubble, and then suddenly you have 10 times as much fuel as you did.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
All right, cool. Hey, killer robots. Gotta love killer robots.
Who doesn't love
Evan,
killer
right?
robots?
The UN, I understand, is very interested in killer robots.
Absolutely, they definitely are. And I should qualify this for the listening audience at home. I'm dressed in the character of Gary King from The World's End, and of course part of the plot of that movie is that his hometown has been infested by robots. The people have all been replaced by robots, and he has to survive
Spoiler
to get to
alert.
The World's End, which is the last bar on the pub crawl, yeah. in order to
Hope you saw it.
Somewhat
Spoilers.
Survive the night. So there you go. Now, in that context, this was a most apropos news item. So what we have is that a senior UN official says battlefield robots that can kill without human control are close to becoming a reality, and they should be banned now, preemptively, right? Better. That's right. The humans need a monopoly on killing people, not these robots. Her name's Angela Kane, UN High Representative for Disarmament. She said governments should be more open about the programs to develop the technology, and she favors this preemptive ban. You know, because basically these robots would otherwise be committing crimes on the battlefield. Like, you know, what would rein them in, essentially? It would be kind of a really chaotic situation.
So, Evan, so to very loosely quote Full Metal Jacket, they don't want us to put a robot behind the trigger.
That is very loosely quoting that movie.
Yeah.
Not a robot that can control the firing mechanism itself, no.
Yeah,
still has to be in, human control.
Well, I'm not certain that we're close. Number one, like when they say close, are they saying like 5 years, or is he talking 50 years?
Yeah, no, they say when they say very close, I think they mean a few years.
To be clear, we're not talking Cylons, right? We're talking just like a computer that can use an algorithm and sensory information or whatever in order to decide how to target and activate armaments. You know, so essentially, the loop is closed without there being a human at any point in the process from deciding what to target and pulling the trigger.
All right. Okay, so autonomous making its own decisions.
Autonomous killer robots. Yeah, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, has anybody seen Red Dog? Or what was that thing called? You know, that weird...
Yeah.
Joel, you've seen it, right? That weird robot.
Big dog, yeah.
It's got the weird... The dog, the legs look like they're backwards.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, right? And if they put
thing.
Like
I
a freaking
it.
It looks like gun the, on top of that thing...
It looks like the dog from... What is it? Oh, Fahrenheit 451. Yeah, right. That crazy, like, spider.
But it's like really jumpy, you know, the way it works. But if they put a turret on top of that, there you go.
Mm-hmm. There
That'd
you
be
go.
Scary.
Okay, so all right. Now I agree with you.
The argument against this person from the UN is that we are actually further away from this technology than we think. The basic programs that we have now that are sort of going in this direction leave us a lot of room and still a lot of control to prevent this from ever happening. So that's the main argument against it. No, you know, I kind of don't either.
I don't know. As long as it's possible for humans to pull the plug when they need to, right? I mean, there's got to be...
Kill switch?
Yeah, there's got to be a kill switch, you know, that... Or even more than that, there should be at some point a human has to confirm, yes, I want this to happen.
But Steve, we shouldn't have a robot in charge of the kill switch.
And there's, you know, and it's not just... The problem isn't just what if something goes wrong and it starts killing people we don't want killed. There is the very serious problem of just our continual march towards making it easier and easier to kill anyone.
Yeah.
You know, and that's part of the problem with drones is, you know, doing the step removal process where now people are playing a video game and they don't necessarily need to suffer the psychological consequences of killing a person, although of course they still do.
But what if our robots kill all of their robots and you win? Then, I mean, that will happen at some point. We can't be the, you know, somebody has to be the first nation to
I don't think anybody's going to be, like, targeting the robots, though.
No, but I think Bob's saying
sure,
is
we're
like,
not.
There could be a robot
because you could kill the people
situation.
And your problem is solved much more quickly.
Robots will be fighting robots. I can guarantee
I think you just want that to happen.
It has to happen.
You're trying to will that into existence because you saw Real Steel and got super excited.
No, come on. You know, we send in our Terminators to kill their soldiers, and then they send in their robots to kill our soldiers, but no soldiers are around. It's just all robots fighting.
But that's rarely the way it's worked in the past. It's rarely been, you know, we had the Cold War, but in most other circumstances we have technology trumping, like technology being used because it is advanced over your opponent's technology. And so it's not a meeting of two equally ferocious technologies usually, you know?
Yeah, they don't.
And when
I
that does happen, we
equal.
Have something like the Cold War, which
I
is
think
very
it's a complicated
you know?
Issue because I can give some good arguments why we might want them. One is I would certainly rather send robots in than say my son. Right? Our kids are, you know, 18 to 25-year-olds. That's one. Want me to keep going? I don't have any more of them.
I was calling your bluff.
Yeah,
nice.
Well,
I mean, that being said, I mean, you know, it's like the way that the military works, it's who's got a leg up, and this might be the next leg up. I have one comment, though. Like, I think of ISIS. Everybody aware of what ISIS is? And I'm reading all this stuff, and they have billions of dollars and everything. That is scary stuff, man. I don't know. Would you say no to sending robots to handle that situation?
Absolutely, I would say no.
Yeah, but again, the transition phase is going to be using robots as a force multiplier, right? So you have a soldier who has robotic enhancements or other, like the robotic dog to carry gear, and then, you know, a tank, and then the tank has some automated functions, and then you just get more and more automated so that you're controlling it. You don't have to actually be in the tank, so you're not putting yourself at risk. Yeah. And each step of the way, right, you're just putting our soldiers less and less at risk, and you're getting force multipliers. And it's hard as a nation with the technology to say no, right, that we're going to put our soldiers in harm's way rather than technology in harm's way. But Rebecca's right, that does put us, eventually we turn around and we have a situation where we have, you know, automated killer robots, you know, and the question just is, you know, how many fail safes do we have in place? We're having this argument about drones too, you know, the idea of you have a drone that could basically fly itself to a target and destroy it. You still have humans directing it, telling it what to blow up. But you know, we probably have the technology now. If somebody wanted to write the program to just have software do the targeting,
yeah,
you know.
And the problem ultimately becomes one of an increased reliance on militarization and murder as your tool. You know, and once you know when you've got a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so, you know, I think it's one part of a much larger conversation about our military-industrial complex.
So there is a website called stopkillerrobots.org.
Tough to argue with the name.
Which is further evidence that there's a website for everything. So there
is also a pornographic version of this website.
It's expensive, though.
We all know exactly what they're doing.
That's stopkillerrobots.com. Don't get this. Like the whitehouse.com and .org. You don't want to get those confused. Something is here. What is here?
There's nothing.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah,
ESP.
Yeah.
I should have known that.
This was a mistake.
I don't think it was a mistake.
We decided, you know, at this Dragon Con, we wanted to do something different. We've never walked over to the paranormal track and sat in on a session just to see what was going on over there. Yeah. We thought we would review it. We would, you know, watch it so that you guys don't have to, and we'll tell you what happens over there. So we went to a session this afternoon on ESP. It was Michelle Griffin was running it. One woman was running the thing. So I mean, you know, it was remarkably lame, as you might imagine. But several things struck me. So this session was about teaching the audience to use their own ESP, because we're all psychic, right? Yeah. This isn't a gift that only a few people have.
Everybody
can do it.
She said it's the sixth sense.
Yeah,
and the way she was describing it to the audience was, it really isn't anything special. We all have it. It's just part of our senses, and you just have to dial yourself into it. And she started with remote viewing, and I'm going to teach everybody how to remote view, right? So she had a first she did a relaxation thing, because you have to be very relaxed.
Let's do it with the audience. Sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
okay.
All right.
So,
can we try to view what's happening on the paranormal track right now using remote viewing? Yeah,
I want to do what she did. So she has a picture, and first she teaches you how to relax and calm down, you know, close your eyes and meditate. She plays the music you think she would play. And then once, right, just a
tickling bells and a recorder.
What's remarkable is how little has changed. Like 100 years ago, this was what happened. There's been no progression.
They got to up the game a little.
Yeah, they can't up the game. That's the thing. It's like you have, you know, an alleged expert, you know, on a panel on ESP, and they have nothing to say. There's like no specialized knowledge there. In fact, I'm sure that anyone in this room could fake their way through an hour panel on ESP
running
the panel.
We should do a whole panel about that. How to fake your way through a paranormal panel.
Make stuff up that you've heard, and that's what she was saying. It's all energy and blah, blah, blah. It's like, there was nothing there.
Yeah, she said, they love to quote, like, you can't create or destroy, you know, energy, and thoughts are energy. So it's always there, and it's constantly coming out of
Except
us.
Yeah, it could be transformed into a version that can't do any work. That's the physics.
Or how about this? How many times have you thought of somebody and they called you on the phone?
Oh, yeah,
it's like you're still using that as an example.
So anyway, so the whole thing was a demonstration.
People don't even call each other anymore.
That's true. Jeez.
How many times you knew if someone was going to text you,
right,
and they texted you?
Yeah. At least update your shtick.
Yeah.
Rebecca, she referenced the Stargate project as well.
Yeah.
Yes. Stargate?
The government Stargate project from the
70s. I'm thinking, you mean the one where they spent $10 million and shut it down because it had no results, that one?
Yeah, that's the one.
That was her best evidence, there were no results. Basically.
That's right. So here we go. We're going to do a remote viewing exercise. So I have a picture selected. It's the next slide on the slideshow. And I know what it is. I'm going to project it to you. So you're going to precog, remote view, and do ESP all at the same time. Right? You got the triple threat. I mean, you can't go wrong.
Do we have to relax the audience?
You've got to relax. Take a deep breath. Go to your safe place. And then...
So what are they? What do you want to do?
I want you to think of a location. Yeah. Think of a location. Oh, so we'll fast forward 2 minutes. What should we do? 2 minutes. That's an easy panel. Everyone be quiet for 2 minutes. All right. And then she said, okay. Then now you have an image of the location in your mind. Then, so here's the location.
So no.
Then she had people say, so tell us anything that you thought that might have a connection to this. Like, then starts fishing for any possible connection.
Ground and sky.
Literally was thinking of palm trees.
Yeah. But palm trees are round and the sun is round.
Well, just out of curiosity,
first of all, palm trees are not round.
Did anybody have anything similar to this?
Anyone think of frozen tundra?
Two people.
We have more ESP here than they hit.
Yeah. They didn't have a single hit.
Yeah.
There was like no one thought of the actual picture. It was always like, I was thinking of water. Well, there's water in that. It's frozen water.
Yeah.
Because it's a color, a shape. Like there was pool table balls or one of the items, like pool table balls. Nobody thought of pool table balls. but somebody thought of triangle. Well, there's a triangle on a pool table.
That's right.
Then she did the thing where, you know, you can, the precog is, you might be thinking of the next picture.
Yeah. Yeah. That was my favorite part.
She multiplied the probability of hits because it could be any possible connection, color, shape, any abstract, and then it could also be applied to the next one. And then even then, there were 60, 70 people in the room, and even then there was a couple of really far, obscure connections.
Did she go on to show like 400 images?
No. Well, we bailed after four.
We were
out of here. So it was all we could take. But anyway, so it was just, if I had the balls to stand up and ask, it wasn't a Q&A part, so if I were going to ask a question, I would say, do you think if we did this exercise in a world, just hypothetically, in a world where there was absolutely no ESP whatsoever, that the performance would be any different than it just was?
Yeah.
Because, I mean,
it's a good question.
It wasn't even good. I mean, it was nothing even remotely interesting, right? Yeah. It was just searching for the thinnest connection and doing everything you can to multiply. Plus, she's working a room of 70 people. Like, what's the chance that somebody would have been thinking of something that they could somehow imagine has a connection to the picture?
The question I wanted to ask her was, okay, so let's say that there is ESP and it's working on the level that we just observed in this room. Who gives a shit? It's useless. Nobody, you're not coming up with anything useful or whatever, but the way that she described it, it's always like, you ever get a feeling when you meet someone? Yeah, right? It's like, yeah, I get feelings when I meet people.
Yeah.
Are they okay, those are what? Called... I just stopped myself from swearing. Those are called emotions.
Yeah.
We feel them all the time.
Or you walk into a room and two people had just been fighting and, like, it's tense.
Right,
well, there you can feel their energy. Right. You're feeling their energy, or you're picking up on the vibe.
This is a superpower on par with the Scientologist superpowers, like of salinity and stuff.
Sense hunger. Never get over that.
Yeah, hunger.
Sense needing to use
that's a power.
Yeah.
I'm hungry. You're magical.
Okay. So, have you guys heard of the X Prize?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool. They just announced the finalists for the Qualcomm Tricorder XPRIZE. This is another one of those items, I'm always thinking, this is a highly technical item. There's got to be somebody in the audience who knows more about this than we do. Unfortunately, we usually don't hear from those people until after we record the show. Then they email us and they go, I did my PhD thesis on the topic that you just talked about. And let me point out to you some little detail that
you didn't
know. It was very
Something's happening.
Are you kidding?
That T-shirt reads, "Ask me about."
Ask me about that. Sorry, but Q&A is later. And you're supposed to be asking the cues.
Isn't that just a part of your Hulk costume?
I like
that. That is a very obscure cosplay.
All right, if you can bring it, bring it.
Hey.
So, as you might imagine, this was not a coincidence. Did we fool you? So tell us who you are and why you're sitting up here on the stage with us.
Okay, I'm Jyotika Vamani, and I'm the technical director for the Wendy Schmidt Ocean Health XPRIZE.
Yes.
And she knows what she's talking about because she has a British accent.
Or she's evil.
Or she's evil.
Either one's fine with me.
I live in L.A. I must be.
So tell us about the XPRIZE.
It's a foundation that incentivizes competitions globally for developing technology to help humanity. So anything that's audacious but achievable, like the tricorder, anything that has a global impact, something that perhaps one government thinks is too big for them. So that's where we step in. So the big things.
Which are the ones that are ongoing right now?
We have four active prizes, the tricorder, of course. We have Google Luna, which is to get a robot onto the moon. Then it will travel for 500 meters on the moon and take a video recording and send that back
to Earth. A killer robot?
Yeah, kill all you want on the moon.
But a private robot.
Alien killer robots, right? No. Then we have the Nokia Sensing XPRIZE, which is kind of related to the tricorder. So the tricorder will sense 15 different illnesses.
Will it sense hunger?
No. No. It doesn't do superpowers,
oh,
Steve. Come on.
Regular powers. Yeah.
Things like diabetes, stroke, that kind of stuff. So you are all Star Trek fans, right? Okay. Now, you won't believe the number of audiences I have that I have to explain what a tricorder is first.
I have a question. Are they going to make it make the cool noise even if it doesn't need to?
Oh, I don't know. I'll have to ask. Maybe that's a bonus prize. There you go. There you go, yeah. I'll take that back to them and suggest it. And then the one I'm working on is the Ocean Health XPRIZE, which is to develop pH sensors to detect ocean acidification. And actually, you know, you were talking about the food issue earlier and the doubling of food. Well, part of that, I think, is because with ocean acidification, they think that the seafood supply will decrease.
Oh, okay. So that might play into why we have to produce more food, and it can't, if it's not coming from the ocean, it has to be land-based. Yeah.
Why we're not doubling population but doubling food. So I don't know for sure, but right now we don't know what's going on in the oceans, so we just don't have the sensing technology.
So what were some of the biggest and best previous X Prizes that changed our lives?
The biggest one that you may have heard of is the Ansari XPRIZE, which was the first one. The XPRIZE itself was launched in 1996 and was awarded on October 4th, 2004, so we're coming up for the 10-year anniversary. And that was for the first team to develop a privately funded spacecraft to take up to 3 people 100 kilometers into the atmosphere twice in 2 weeks. It was a $10 million prize. Team spent $100 million of private R&D. The winning team was backed by Paul Allen. The technologies that were developed at that time have led to now this private space flight industry. Before that, it was all government. And so it's now a $2 billion or so industry.
Yeah.
So that's one of the big, big ones.
So it really kickstarted the private space flight. And we were chatting before, we had lunch together. You were saying that that's very similar to the commercial airline industry. It was also started by the similar.
Yeah. So, yeah, prize competitions, you may not know how they affect you in your day-to-day life. So you were talking about the Ortigue Prize, which was in the early 1900s. There was a French hotelier who lived in New York, and he wanted to travel across the Atlantic faster than ships could take them. So he put up $25,000 for the first person to fly across the Atlantic. 6 people died in the attempt, But it was won in 1927 by an unknown pilot called Charles Lindbergh. So that's what made Charles Lindbergh famous, but it also kick-started the aviation industry. So how many of you flew in on planes to DragonCon?
10 people flew here. Everybody mentioned Atlanta.
An 87 introverts.
Hey, why no XPRIZE for artificial intelligence or nanotechnology or something?
Yeah.
Really
something
awesome.
Bob wants. Yes, okay.
Actually, at the TED Talks earlier this year, our founder, Peter Diamandis, and CEO, he announced an AI XPRIZE for a robot that could self-teach and self-give a TED Talk.
Wow.
Okay.
So I don't know the details of that yet, but it's not a killer robot, I just want to let you know. It's a talking robot.
Non-killing talking robot. Got it.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
So each week, I come up with three science news items or facts. Two are real and one is fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. The theme is spaceflight. Spaceflight.
Awesome. Let's do it.
Okay. So I'll read the questions, then I'll poll the audience. We'll get the expert opinions, and then we'll see how they affected the audience. All right, here we go. Item number one, the record for most time spent in space is held by cosmonaut Sergei Krikalev, who has spent 2.2 years in space. Item number two, in 1962, astronaut John Young, as pilot of Gemini 3, smuggled his pet hamster onto the spacecraft. The pet became loose, and when NASA was informed, they ordered Young to evacuate the capsule before the hamster could cause any damage.
God, I hope that's science.
And item number three, the Vostok 1 carrying Yuri Gagarin on the first manned spaceflight was not designed to land with an occupant, so Gagarin had to eject at 4 miles up. I'll add that the Soviets hid that fact from the rest of the world because it would not have qualified him for the first manned spaceflight. Okay, so first we'll ask the audience, who thinks the one about Sergei spending 2.2 years in space is the fiction?
Wow.
All right.
Couple.
Okay.
Three bold people, very good. All right, number two, who thinks the one about John Young bringing his pet hamster on board the spacecraft is the fiction? And how many people think Yuri Gagarin having to eject from his capsule at 4 miles up is the fiction?
Yeah. All right, so kind of even. With
two and three. So, all right, so let's start on the right this time. Evan, why don't you tell us what you think?
2.2 years in space of total time. That's a long time. That's a lot of missions, and or 4 6-month missions roughly. I don't know. It could be a little off there. The hamster one, wow. Pet became loose, and when NASA was informed, they ordered Young to evacuate the capsule. Gee, why haven't I heard about this before?
Right? Yeah.
This is really strange, Steve. Something like this, I don't know, would have necessarily escaped our collective discussions that we've previously had about NASA and other things. It's never come up on the show. Yeah. I've never read it anywhere. First time I'm ever hearing about it. I'm suspicious. The last one, Yuri Gagarin, was not designed to land with an occupant, had to eject 4 miles up. I think that's the most plausible of the three. I'm going to go with the audience and say it's the hamster one's the fiction.
Okay, Jay?
Yeah, so 2.2 years, I think that's science. And I noticed that you didn't say what spacecraft he was in. And I think that would have helped us realize that one is science. The second one, I have one question for you, is where did John Young hide the hamster? No, seriously.
In the cockpit.
Think about it. Right? They're not like blasé about the these guys going in their spacesuits. You know, like, how do you do it?
In the glove compartment.
Anyway, that one is really iffy, Steve. I mean, me and my 10 friends that flew in here all think that one is definitely the fake. And the last one, I don't want to make anybody think I'm being prejudiced against the Russians, but I definitely think that they would let a guy dive out at 4 miles up, like really you know, it's janky, you know? Oh, and by the way, as you get, he's getting on the ship, right? Oh, one more thing. Yeah. There's a red button in there. When you see the ocean, press that, you know, or something like that. So, yeah, number two, the hamster. No
the
way.
Hamster,
no
okay. Way. Rebecca?
I need the hamster to be true.
We all want the hamster
I
to
need
be
it.
True. It doesn't make
so wait,
sense.
When you say he had to evacuate the capsule, are you saying that he blew that hamster out the airlock?
Saying they put their space helmets on and they evacuated the capsule of atmosphere to make sure, because they couldn't go hunting through the wires for it. They had to kill it.
Oh, now I need it to not be true. But still, I want it to be true. So I'm going to say that's science. So it's between the other two for me. 4 miles. That seems very high up and mean. I mean, not as mean as murdering a hamster that didn't do anything to you.
What is that about? How many feet is that?
Well, it's 5,280 feet in a mile, so it's about...
It's pretty high up there.
So, yeah, I'm going to flip a coin. I'm going to say that... You know what? I'm going to be contrarian. I'm going to go against the audience, and I'm going to say that 2.2 years in space is the wrong thing. Okay. Yeah, I'm with you two people.
Okay. Bob? Bob?
Wake up, Bob.
We're already over time, Bob.
No, 14 minutes. I've got problems with everything here. 2.2 seemed too good. I mean, it just... God, I remember reading about some of these long stays in space, and that sounds just too reasonable. I think there might have been some that were... I don't know. I can't make up my mind about that one. The hamster one, yeah, I thought what Jay thought, although not as nasty as Jay thought it. I was thinking, you know, where would the hamster go? Did he have a pocket? Did he? I know they were locked down so hard, it would be hard to hide the squirming
Which
thing.
Which proves my point.
Well,
thank you.
Okay. So, but... And then the capsule.
What the hell did he think he was going to do with the hamster, though? Like, what?
First hamster in space. Done.
It's so stupid.
Pick up chicks at the bar later. You know, I took the first hamster into space.
I mean, at that time, oh. At that time,
was
they
that
weren't
a turn on.
Do me.
Do me.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I'd
Steve,
hit that.
Control these two.
Jay, punchy.
At that time, Jay, they were. I mean, you went for a bunch of orbits. You weren't hanging out for days or
yeah,
weeks.
But what did he do with it? What was
Maybe
his plan with the hamster? He's going to play
I,
with
I
his
hear
hamster.
You, Jay.
Yeah. Yeah.
The problem with Gagarin is, I don't know, ejecting at 4 miles up. I mean, to have your capsule ejectable. Huh?
Sorry.
To have the astronaut ejectable, I think would be an important redesign of the capsule itself to make it so that you can eject. They don't have sea landings, sea splashdowns. They're always on hard ground, pretty much. So they know that. Oh man, this one is tough.
Give us an answer.
I'm gonna go with Rebecca because my first skepticism was that first number 2.2. So I'm gonna say that one's
okay. All right. All right. So
you and me, and those two guys.
Two people is like, all right. So let's see if you guys had any influence on our very skeptical audience. Now, how many of you think that the 2.2 years is the fiction?
Five people.
I doubled it. Four people.
How many people think the hamster's a fiction?
Too easy.
And how many people think Gagarin ejecting is a fiction?
Wow.
I think
we might all be in
Gagarin.
Here.
Yeah.
All right. I thought two had a slight edge over three, but we'll see. All right. Let's start with, since nobody on the panel chose number three, let's start there. The Vostok 1 carrying Yuri Gagarin on the first manned spaceflight was not designed to land with an occupant, so Gagarin had to eject at 4 miles up. Everyone on the panel thinks this one is science, and this one is... science.
Yes.
Very interesting. The capsule was spherical. It was ball-shaped so that it would... it actually made it easier for a single person inside because no matter what, there wouldn't be any buffeting, you know, from the wind and whatnot because it was round. So it was made for Gagarin's comfort, but because it was round, it couldn't be oriented, which means no retro rockets, nothing. If it couldn't be oriented in a specific direction, there was no way to slow it down. So that thing was going to just slam into the Earth. So he had to eject it 4 miles up. They did hide that fact from the world because they were afraid that we wouldn't count that as returning a man to, you know, to the Earth in the capsule.
Oh, come on.
Didn't quite count.
Sure,
so they didn't tell anybody that they did it that way. They had to redesign later capsules, of course, to accommodate actually landing with the occupant. Maybe they didn't think it was going to survive. Who knows? I don't know. All right, let's go back to number one.
Terrible.
Well, you know, didn't they leave dogs up there? The record for most time spent in space is held by cosmonaut Sergei Krikalev, who has spent 2.2 years in space. Bob and Rebecca think this one is the fiction.
Yes.
Three people in the audience do also. And this one is... Now, you know, I didn't say...
Seriously, with this shit?
I'm
seriously
so tired of it.
It's so played out.
If he did, if it was 2.2 years
nobody
all
cares
at once...
Nobody wants to hear what you're
saying. Or if
right
it
now
was...
What is
added,
it?
Just say it.
Just say it. Science.
This please one is science.
Ah.
I love you anyway.
Of course.
Sergei had multiple missions in the Soyuz, the Mir, the shuttle, and the ISS.
All right, so we just assumed that it was all at once. That was the problem.
It was not all at once.
No, I didn't.
It was,
I did not assume that.
In multiple different missions, 2.2 years.
That's a long time.
That's a long time in space.
That's a lot of space time.
Okay, so all of this means that the majority of the audience is correct. Give yourself a round of
applause. Yeah. Whatever.
In 1962, astronaut John Young, as pilot of Gemini 3, smuggled his pet hamster onto the spacecraft. The pet became loose, and when NASA was informed, they ordered Young to evacuate the capsule before the hamster could cause any damage. That one is the fiction.
You made the whole thing up?
It was a rooster. It wasn't a hamster.
No, I didn't. It was.
And I have a question.
Wait, I didn't make the whole thing up.
Well, it was a cock.
It's based on a real story.
Where did he put that cock, Evan?
In the cockpit.
How could I not go there?
Come on.
Taylor,
God. Hey.
He did smuggle
something. Let me describe something the ways you could have not gotten.
He smuggled trinkets with him.
So what did
he
John
smuggled
Young...
smuggled trinkets with him.
Not trinkets. Does anybody know?
Little capsules, little metal
a
capsules.
A roast beef sandwich. Somebody in the audience said it.
Awesome.
He smuggled a roast beef sandwich.
That's bigger than a hamster.
It's bigger than a hamster. And he got it past NASA. And he was officially reprimanded for doing this. Because you're not
astronaut
supposed to do that. Yeah, you're not supposed to smuggle stuff up there. I guess he was worried he would get hungry and, you know, he needed a snack. And
that's
this
awesome.
It prompted a NASA investigation about what other astronauts have been smuggling up in those capsules that they never knew about.
Is there a list?
Apparently, but I couldn't find
God,
it.
God, I would love to know that.
So, but I made the hamster bit up, but he did smuggle.
Really, it was so
thank
obvious
God that hamster's not in existence, rather than
yeah,
being
that,
killed
right
by a
there plate was no dead hamster.
He did eventually
ending
eat the roast beef sandwich, Rebecca. So
okay, we can all take right a couple of questions. Maybe?
Seems so obvious. Now.
I think we can take. Seems so obvious now. I think we can take. There is a mic in the middle of that aisle.
Where did he put it?
If somebody gets there really quickly. Who has mad Jedi skills.
Whoa.
Yes.
We might be able to take
ESP
a question.
Yeah, that was ESP. Yeah.
Are you hungry?
Of course.
So just to make sure we got the audio, the question is, what is the role of imagination in science and skepticism? Which is a great question, and it is something that we get asked a lot, because even just today, some guy comes up to the table, not a skeptic, not familiar, he's like, what are you guys skeptical of? What does that mean? Like, if you hear something, you say, I don't believe it, rather than investigating? It's like, no, the opposite. It means we investigate it. That's the whole point. So, yeah, there is this sense that, you know, skepticism is negative, but, you know, that's only because there's a certain amount of science is negative. Einstein said science is 1% inspiration, which is, I think, a very critical part of it, but it's 99% perspiration. And that 99% is figuring out what's actually true. It's a very negative process of weeding away the things that are not true. There's no way to do that science. But you absolutely need the creativity. You need the imagination. You know, if you can't think of new ways to explain things, you have nothing to test, right? I mean, you have to... That's why I always get annoyed when people say, oh, scientists are always just protecting the dogma and the status quo. Wrong. That can't be more wrong, because science is about thinking of new ways of imagining the universe. It is all imagination. But of course, then you have to do the work. Otherwise, you're just some guy in his living room shooting shit. You know, you're not a scientist. You're just everyone who just likes to think that they can think about stuff about the universe. So you have to do both the imagination and the hard work of actually showing what's true and what's not true.
It was Edison.
Was it Edison?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Anybody Thank else?
You. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the question is, should we be teaching basic experimental design at the undergraduate level? I think we should be teaching it at pretty much every level.
Oh, absolutely.
Elementary school. Both critical thinking and just the nature of science. You know, obviously we have to teach about the findings of science, but it's more important, in my opinion, to teach about the logic and the process that goes behind science. It's amazing that you can get to a high level of being a scientist, you know, even, you know, graduate and even doing science. And a lot of your training about experimental design and the logic of experimentation has been pretty much haphazard and taught almost as an apprentice model, unless you went out of your way. I mean, there are courses in it, but unless you went out of your way to take such a course, you know, you could get through the system and still have some pretty significant misconceptions about how scientific methodology is supposed to work, just depending on who you trained under. You know, who you trained under is critical because it's not systematic and it's not done at every level. So I absolutely agree. I think we should more systematically be teaching, you know, how, you know, all of the various aspects of scientific methodology. So the flying spaghetti monster has just indicated with its noodly appendage that we are out of time, and we have just enough time for Jay to give us a closing quote.
All right, the quote sent in by a listener named Stephen Wilhelm, and the quote is, "I don't know what I may seem to the world, but as to myself, I seem to have been only like a boy playing on the seashore and diverting myself now and then in finding a smoother pebble or a prettier shell than the ordinary, whilst the great ocean of truth lay all undiscovered before me." That is Sir Isaac Newton!
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Thank you. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.